Good morning, everyone. This is Jeanette Smith from All Art Licensing, and I want to welcome you today to the first in our Art Licensing Essentials Conference. The first class is Art Licensing Essentials, an Introduction to Profits, Promotions, and Protection. So please follow along with your PowerPoint as we go through each slide, and of course I'll be giving you a lot of extra information than what you've got there, and just to please absorb it all, take notes, and you'll be have the audio recording so that you can be listening to this several times. All right. Here we go. We're on slide two, and I just wanted to start this conference with a little bit of my background so that you understand where I'm coming from. I actually started my career many years ago in an advertising agency, and I love that background. It gives you a lot of marketing, advertising, and promotional skills, and I really enjoy marketing creative properties. And my advertising background, I actually took it to New York, where I worked in the travel business for many years, and then found the publishing and licensing industries, which are just my favorite. So it was at United Media that I picked Dilbert as a cartoon that I really thought would explode on the marketplace. And so I spent about 6 years in New York working with Scott Adams as we built the property into a $200 million retail property. This was a wild ride through everything from publishing to television, 750 different licensees and products, and it was just a tremendous opportunity. So All Art Licensing, what we try to do is take all of that experience and the many different other creators, authors that I've worked with, and help you bring your property to a new level. So today I work as an agent, I work as a coach and consultant, and work with everyone from fine artists to illustrators, cartoonists, authors, businesses, brands. And of course, we're on slide number four. I also do a lot of teaching for the National Graphic Artists Guild, Self-Employment in the Arts, at the Licensing Expo, and Certex, things like that. So I really enjoy teaching and helping people understand their art businesses from a different angle. So let's go ahead and turn now to slide number five. So let's start by talking about how you generate revenue. If you have a picture, a painting, a photograph, or anything, a piece of sculpture that you sell one of, you make exactly as much money as that original that you have created, the value that someone else perceives it has, and so that's what you can sell it for. So, but if you're a gallery owner and you're making copies, you're making giclées of those paintings or photographs, you now can sell hundreds of the same piece. And that's really the very, very basics of licensing that we're going to be diving into today and talking about this crazy industry called licensing. All right, so on slide six, I'm actually giving you a definition of licensing that you can hold on to. It's the actual act of leasing the rights to a trademark or copyrighted entity. And of course, it can be used with products or services. Even advertising uses licensing. They license cartoon characters for use in advertisements. I think of Geico. The Geico Gecko is their own character that they've created, but they've used everybody from Fred Flintstone and the Jetsons to, I can't even name all the different characters that have appeared in the Geico commercials. So they're leasing the rights to use that character, or someone is leasing the rights to utilize your art or photography, and they're paying you basically rent for the time that they're using it. So as the owner of the rights, you're the licensor. As the leaser of the rights, that person is the licensee. And that's pretty important lingo, shall we say, industry lingo, for you to get in your head. Because people will throw those out and you've got to make sure you know which is which. You're the licensor. You own the trademarks and copyrights to whatever you've created. All right, on slide number 7. So the legal grant of rights is what we do when we license something. And we want to make sure that we're identifying what those rights are. This is what contracts do. We'll be talking more about that in our actual fourth part of this series. But in general, for a piece of art, a logo, a brand, a likeness, a photograph, or a combination of any of those, you're going to grant those rights for a specific purpose or term in a specific territory in return for a negotiated amount. As I said, the rent. And that's exactly what you want to make sure you've got organized when you do a licensing deal. Now, on slide 8, I'm showing you a very simplified diagram to help you understand the flow of licensed product, how it gets from the creator all the way to the consumer. The consumer is your end user, your target audience for the end user. It's the same thing. All right. So you as the creator are developing the art. The manufacturer is now producing it. The retailer is selling it, and the consumer is buying it. So there's your flow. Making sure that you understand, and today we're going to talk a lot about the different roles that these different players play in licensed product. So slide 9 begins this process of diving in a little deeper, shall we say. As an artist or a licensor, you want to prepare your sales materials, which we'll, again, be talking a lot about. How do you actually do that? And that comes up in part 2 of the Art Licensing Essentials mini conference. So you prepare your sales materials, and then you either find manufacturers yourself or an agent helps you find manufacturers. Going around the circle, right by our logo there, it talks about negotiating with the manufacturer, who is the licensee. Then the manufacturer produces and sells the product. They also warehouse it and do all the shipping and distribution things. Now the retailer then stocks it and sells it, and when the consumer buys it, sales increase and demand increases. So you basically are then revving up and priming the pump for more sales and for you to do more deals. So I think that if you can really understand this entire process and maybe the different, shall we say, the different tactics and things that have to be implemented at each stage, you're now really getting a handle on all the elements in the licensing process. So now on slide 10, I want to take a few slides and dive into describing the size of the licensing industry. This is a snapshot for 2013 because it's really the 2014 numbers aren't out yet. Retail sales of worldwide licensed products, everything, is $155.8 billion. You're entering into a really, really huge industry. And you're doing so in the largest country in the world in terms of dollar volume of licensing. U.S. and Canada combined now equals 62.5% of all licensed products sales. All right? So in the global marketplace, it's a pretty darn exciting place to be, and that's why I get a lot of people from the international markets wanting to talk about licensing, because they're coming to us to see how it's done and to be involved in this industry. You can do more licensing in the U.S. than in those other countries, so make sure you develop a good base here. That's the message I want to reflect from those numbers, be reflected from those numbers. So the U.S. is generating about $112 billion in retail sales. And in U.S. royalties, approximately almost $5.5 billion. Remember that royalties are always going to be a tenth or a twentieth of your retail sales. And that's because they equal just the royalties generated and being paid to agents and property managers or artists such as yourself. And art licensing is about 3% of the entire industry. It's small, but it's been steady for quite a while, and there's still continues to be a lot of need and demand for art. On page 11, we're going to just flip through some of the top art licensors in the world. These are the ones that are making the big bucks, right? So all the dollars here that you're going to see are in millions. This first one, So So Happy and Sklanimals, were created by, I believe, Cindy Petrop Bailey, who developed the Art Impressions company. She did these design and lifestyle brands, and they have just exploded to a point where last year they were acquired by Entertainment One. So Entertainment One is a $770 million business. These two properties are a portion of those. So I'm not quite sure. They may actually be a small portion of them, but we don't have the numbers pulled out. But they did start as art properties. On slide 13, I've pulled a couple of the American Greetings favorite properties. This is Strawberry Shortcake and the Care Bears, and a wonderful story, actually. The Tom Wilson, who created the Ziggy comic strip, the original creator, his son, Tom Wilson Jr., a good friend of ours, actually is drawing and creating Ziggy now. But his father created the Care Bears and Strawberry Shortcake as an employee of American Greetings. So if you can imagine the kind of money his family would be making if they owned the rights to these properties. But they were created when he was on the job, and maybe many of you have had this experience that you're employed and you're being paid a salary and your creativity is a part of that job. So he actually then created Ziggy on his own and licensed it to American Greetings, where they did millions and millions of dollars in the 70s and later on in greeting cards. So American Greetings has created their own licensing out department that's worth $425 million, a great deal of which is the Care Bears and Strawberry Shortcake. These are really becoming evergreen properties. They're going on and on, and there's different generations now that grandmothers and mothers and kids that love them and care for them. So now you know the story of how they were created and the fact that there are many talented people out there who have gone through the experience of creating something which another company owns and is licensing. On slide 14, you'll see Thomas Kincaid, which he's the painter of light. And he passed away a few years ago, but his $425 million licensing industry is still moving on without him. And he's really one of the biggest fine artists we've ever seen in the licensing industry. He really took what he did and grew it to the point where he was licensing housing developments and really unusual things. If you haven't read up on him ever before, there are some interesting lessons there. And Jim Shore, who is at $162 million, is, of course, a licensing icon. On slide 15, MH Licensing handles two properties in the art licensing arena, which the Hotman Brothers, who do the fine art paintings of wildlife, and Tina Higgins, who does a lot of wildlife and kind of Indian style, a Bombay company, English kind of traditional designs. But Tina Higgins is a very, very brilliant and well-rounded designer, and they've been licensing her for many, many years. So just giving you a couple of examples of their art. Again, any of these people, if you read up on their stories, I think there'd be learning there for you. So give that a shot. You can find their websites online, of course, and many of them have told their stories in interviews and things like that. Next on our list of the top art licensing artists who are licensing themselves these days is the Kathy Davis Studios. Apologize, that's Kathy Davis. And they're doing about $100 million, and that's a solid number because they are an exclusive license. So I do know that we have a solid number there. These are retail sales numbers, of course. Dezero Brands is licensing Rachel Hale, who is a photographer, and I know she, right now they have a set number of photographs that they're licensing, and these numbers are down from 45 million in the prior survey that was done. So I know their numbers are down, and I believe that's because Rachel herself has sold the business to Dezero Brands, and they have a limited number of cute kittens and puppies to license. All right, so these are just the top upper echelon of art licensors. Some of them became lifestyle brands. Actually, most of them became lifestyle brands. Some of them became television properties, but they started in the art licensing arena. So on slide 17, we're going to talk a little bit about your factors that will contribute to your success in art licensing. Of course, the quality of your art is very, very important. And the types of themes that you cover, the subjects that you cover in your art. If you're covering topics that no one's interested in, but you are, that's great. And that can be very, very fulfilling, but it's not going to make for a mass marketable product. So there are the other things that make a difference, like when the artist got started. I have to say, I mean, Mary Engelbreit, it has been around a long time, but she got started very early on, and that certainly made a difference. When she got started, there was far less competition. Hard work and determination, absolutely, no matter when you start, that's an important factor. But I see a lot of artists. I get a lot of presentations sent to me. People wanted me to consider them for agenting and also helping artists find agents. And I do know that the quality of a starving artist can be the same or better than someone who's making $150 million a year. So keep that in mind, because when you believe in yourself and you believe in your art, there's no reason you can't be one of those top people. Or maybe your goal is, I want to make $300,000 a year. And you really can be one of those people. So you don't have to be in the top six to do very, very well for yourself. But just keep in mind that just because you're not there now doesn't mean you can't get to where you want to go. You just need to learn and find the path. So slide 18, we're going to now start diving into the licensed property types, and you've seen and are aware of, I'm sure, character brands, trademarks, fashion, sports. Those are the larger property types. The smaller ones include art, music, publishing, collegiate, nonprofits, and of course the internet's becoming one of the great feeders of licensing these days. And sometimes they come into the art arena, sometimes they go directly to character. Just depends on what happens, but that certainly, they've always been included in the other category. And anyway, but of course, character brands based on televisions and movies tends to be the largest dollar volume category. And you'll see this on the next slide, 19, where I've broken out the sales by property type, and these are the U.S. and Canada numbers only, and these are not the retail sales. These are the licensing revenue. So remember, if these are retail sales, they would be 10 or 20 times as much. Okay? And even with that, the character business is more than $2.5 billion a year. Followed not even closely by your trademarks and brands, which are at $928 million a year. So these are the estimated licensing revenues by property type. And you can see that the art licensing is at $134 million. So it's a good solid property type. And one thing about art licensing is it has really remained quite steady. Everything took a dip in the 2008, 2009, 2010, that time period when the economy in the U.S. took a dip. So art licensing has come back. It's pretty much where it was before that dip, and it's remained constant for about the last 3 years. So art licensing is pretty steady. And I want to remind everybody why, because there's a huge need for art and creativity to make products interesting. Those manufacturers don't have what you have, and they need you. Remember that. They need you. So as you're out there talking to manufacturers, there will be days where they don't need you, right? But in general, think of all the products around the world that if they were all just plain colors, we'd be back in the 1950s, where they were lucky if they came up with a new aqua. my kitchen's pink. My kitchen's aqua now. That was a big deal, right? No longer white. All right. On slide number 20, this now gives you the sales by product category. And I really want to talk a lot about product categories today, because once you learn the product categories that are the most important to the art licensing industry, you'll start to have an idea of where to focus your time and energy. All of this learning has to be focused, has to be prioritized. So in the U.S. and Canada, the estimated licensing revenue these are numbers in millions for 2013, and apparel is the largest category, followed by toys and games, gifts and novelties, and accessories, and food and beverage, and software and video games. So those kind of equal the top portion dollar volume-wise, but you've got your home decor, housewares, beauty following up. So apparel is, and toys and games are by far the biggest, and again, that's because the character licensing for kids flow into those. All right, so if you're so inclined, you can spend more time looking at these numbers, but I wanted to present to you a little bit about the licensing industry just so you have an idea of where you're headed. Slide 21, we're going to now talk about the key roles of the different players in the licensing industry, as well as the timelines and the retail realities. As we get into this more, you'll understand why all of these topics are very, very important. All right, now, if slide 22 looks like a spaceship or something not understandable, let me try to explain. The yellow circle really is all properties. And in it, there's brands, there's art, there's designs, there's characters. It doesn't really matter where they are in it. Any kind of property can be touched by these four different people playing key roles. The licensor, who is the owner and or creator, so you're the licensor of your art, of your photography, of your sculptures. And if you're an author, you're a licensor as well of your words. The licensee is the manufacturer that you want to find. They are in those product categories we just discussed. Of course, you have the retailer who reaches the consumer. And you have an agent that usually represents the licensor, although there are agents called manufacturer reps. And they're basically agents that represent the manufacturers. You'll find them a lot more in that character licensing and apparel arena, because the manufacturers want a specialist, an agent, who goes out and finds them at the best properties, who will compete for the Strawberry Shortcake, the Star Wars, the whatever the XYZ latest hot movie is. So there are people called manufacturers reps. They're like an agent for the manufacturer. You probably won't run into a lot of them in the art licensing industry. The manufacturers pretty much deal with the licensors and the agents for the licensors directly. All right, so there is also a consultant. Well, and if you look on the next page, page 23, really those key roles that I just described are outlined there. And the consultant is really kind of a wild card. The consultant could actually work as an agent or for an agent. They could actually work for the property in any roles, marketing, sales, design, development, things like that. And they could actually work for the manufacturer. So you've got your property, your licensors, your licensees, your agents, retailers, consultants. And those are pretty much the key roles that you need to understand in the licensing industry. And you, as an artist, would either work directly through an agent or with the manufacturers. So how long is this going to take? That's always one of the first questions I get. And on slide 24, we're actually looking at a licensing timeline. So don't let this discourage you. This is not a fast process. But I think that once we go through this and you see that if you have 10 of these going on at once, or 20 or more, or even one or two as you start out, there's plenty to be done at each stage, and you've got to work through all these steps to get to the end result. So the end goal is to have a lot of these going on at once and to understand the process so well that you can just easily keep them all flowing from one step to the next. So within the 6 months, the first year from starting out, if you are an artist and you can start creating your collections and creating your marketing materials, then you're actually getting out, marketing them to people, and say you sign on somebody and it takes them about a week to 3 months from the time that they tell you they want to do a deal, a week to 3 months to actually get you a contract. At that point, you would send them the art, and then it can take them from 3 months to a year to actually produce the product. 3 months is really quick. That might be some stationery product or some napkins or something paper that's printed. Certainly the print-on-demand industry has changed that, because there are places that once your contract's done and your art's uploaded, they can print for an order in 10 days or one day. So this really has to do with a company that's manufacturing and wholesaling and selling to retailers. All right, so once the product is produced, then it might take 3 to 6 months more for the product to be sold by their sales reps and delivered to the stores. And when you add all of those times up, it's a year to 2.5 years for you to start the licensing process and then see your first product in the stores. All right, so on slide 25, let's use that example to apply it to the calendar industry. Calendars are really wonderful. It's a prolific industry. So in reality, because there are so many calendars these days, each one doesn't sell a lot. Also, of course, with electronic calendars coming up, that's another reason that calendars don't sell as well as they used to. There was a time when, I think with Dilber, we had more than 9 different calendar formats, and one of them, the Page a Day, was selling almost 1 million each year. So that was just huge. So if you plan on 2 to 2.5 years until the revenue stream comes in, and you also have to think about budgeting some funds to cover expenses, that's really the kind of timing that you need to think about. For a calendar for 2017, you'd be now doing the licensing deal. I think most people that I've talked to are saying that this spring they will be looking at their calendar opportunities for 2017, and they certainly hope to close those deals by the summer. That means that in the fall of 2015, they're going to be closing the deal, writing the contract, gathering the art, doing the layout, getting it approved by the artist and photographer. Then they are going to do, in 2016, the sales, the printing, the distribution. And really, they need to be distributed by July. They need to be shipping. They need to be in the stores August to September. That's the big back-to-school time. They start selling calendars. Then, obviously, October, November, December, they're putting a huge push on calendars for gift-giving. And, of course, they're discounted on January 1st. And a little bit, you get a little bump of sales there in January and tax time. But that's about it. And then they're out of there. And people return, or, you know, they either deep discount the calendars or they return them. So there's just an example of one product and the timeline that you have in terms of sales, production and sales. All right. Now we're going to dive into, we're diving into everything today. The good news and the bad news of the retail marketplace. So these are the retail realities. And a lot of people don't realize how much you need to know about the retail marketplace. You're in a retail business. You're now marketing your art for products, and those products will be sold at retail, whether it's through the internet or whether it's through a distribution house that sells worldwide or some boutiques in your neighborhood. It's all retail. And in fact, the bad news is that retailers are what we call gatekeepers. I'm on slide 27, and the gatekeepers are really the holders of the power in this industry. A studio actually many years ago, the studios did their own distribution. They learned that if they did not control the distribution, their movies that they created wouldn't get out to the consumers. They learned the hard way. Other manufacturers have learned the hard way. And that's why you see a lot of people now actually creating their own products and doing their own distribution. They want to control the entire supply chain from, you know, whether it's, you know, creating the product, manufacturing it, wholesaling it, and distributing it. They want control over everything, because if you are dependent on the gatekeepers, on the retailers, then you can't get to the consumer. So think about what you can do and maybe balance your licensee list with people who go direct to consumers and some that go through retailers. Anyway, it's just an important point, because if you don't think about retailers as gatekeepers, you're being unrealistic about the industry. So the power of retailers is tremendous, absolutely tremendous. But on slide 28, we can look at the different options. So these are production and, well, really product distribution models, because there's different ways to get to the consumer. One is you produce it and you sell it to the consumer. So you're creating your own greeting cards and you're going to the farmer's market and you're selling them. So there you go. You could also create brownies and go sell them at the local bake store. You could actually create a product and sell it on the internet. You can take your art and put it on mugs and sell them to the consumer on Etsy or Zazzle. So selling directly to the consumer, as soon as the internet came along and retail sales became possible through the internet, then the retailer did lose a little bit of its power. As a producer, you can sell directly to retailers who sell to the consumer, or of course, a producer can sell to a wholesaler. A wholesaler basically takes a lot of different types of products. I mean, they might combine think about a bathroom ensemble. The company could either manufacture their own rugs and bath mats, rugs, toothbrush holders, soap holders, shower curtains. They could produce all those things, sell them to the retailer and the consumer, or they could gather those products from other people, warehouse them, and be a distributor to retailers, specializing in the bathroom accessories. So look at this chart, understand where you fit in it, and that you're over here on the left side feeding the production of manufacturers with your art, but that they are going to go through one of these different channels. So it's important to be able to understand it as you're talking to your manufacturer partners. I love that. I mean, you have got to think about both manufacturers and agents as being your business partners. All right, well, slide 29 talks a little bit about those distribution channels. We're going to look back a little bit to understand where retail came from, and maybe it helps make sense of where we are today. But originally, people shopped in the kinds of stores that their income level allowed them. So if they felt that they were an upscale person and they could afford it, then they would shop only at the upper tier or the upstairs stores. And then there was mid-tier stores and downstairs stores, which were called the lower tier or mass market. And mass market really didn't start until a lot later, but now we associate downstairs with the mass market. Today, you do not have the division of upstairs, mid-tier, downstairs. It's much more homogenous and blurred. You kind of know that Macy's and Bloomingdale's and, you know, Nordstrom's are upstairs. You do know that. Target gets a little blurry. They consider themselves upstairs, but they are certainly mass market. Barnes & Noble is considered a specialty retailer, but they're certainly mass market. So you can see it gets real confusing. But there's some important decisions that have to be made about where you fit at retail. So let's look at the challenges that each of the different types of retailers experience today. At the mass market level, there's just too many stores with too much of the same thing. There's no distinction. There's no uniqueness. They're battling for the same dollars. So are you going to Kmart? Are you going to Walmart? Are you going to Costco or Sam's Club or whatever? You can get high-end products there, low-end products there, but they're big, massive, and around the corner, and they carry everything. You probably don't shop at a lot of them. You're probably making a decision based on geography as to where you go. whichever one's closest to you. So their challenge then is too many stores with too much of the same thing. So that means they're battling for your dollar with pennies, with discounts of pennies. In the mid-tier area, that's the regional chains. You'd have your Kohl's, your Sears, your JCPenney's, different places that are, you know, not, they are mass market, but they're not that big. And honestly, this is the area that barely exists anymore, this mid-tier. They're really struggling. And they're struggling because they're not as cheap as the mass market. And they're trying to be a higher end, but they don't really have necessarily the quality of product that a high end does. So licensing actually feeds into this really well. What the mid-tier retailers are doing is a lot of exclusives with designers. So Isaac Mizrahi or Cynthia Rowley, different fashion designers are doing exclusives with a retail chain. And that starts to give them a little bit of a distinction. And if you like those designers, maybe you'll go there. Maybe that will influence you buying other things there. That's one of the things that they're counting on with these exclusives, is to utilize them to not only sell those products, but to help them sell other products. They're also doing a lot more of the kind of experiential boutiques. So you can go in and see all of the products gathered together and how your bedroom or your office or your living room might look with this line and this line combined. Anyway, they're doing everything they can to fight the losing battle that they're experiencing. The high-end and specialty stores have just experienced a slaughter in the past 10, 15 years. There are so few mom-and-pop stores left. There are so few specialty retailers. A lot of the specialty boutiques, small retailers, have actually become boutiques in, say, grocery stores. Or we now go to Whole Foods and shop for cards there, even though, you know, their little designer area is more convenient and has nice quality, unique products. And that's kind of what we went to that mom and pop store for. So our shopping habits have really changed, and the retail marketplace has really changed with it. I want to point out that many, many, many years ago, a artist could start out in the art licensing field, and just through manufacturers that focus on specialty retailers, they could get 3, 5, 10 deals and get their business started. And that is one thing that I think has been hard for the artists, because they no longer have that entry place that's comfortable and simple. Another reality of the retail marketplace is private label licensing. This is going on in certainly the supermarkets, drugstores, mass merchandisers. They're branding a private label product, so it might be Walmart's, you know, Bugaboo character. I'm making this up. But they may make up a character that is on their Band-Aids. But they also might license for their own Walmart brand Band-Aids Fred Flintstone, whereas Band-Aid brand might have Superman on it. So what they're doing is they're taking a private label product, which is probably manufactured by the same major manufacturer, but they're putting their own packaging, their own Walmart brand or Target brand or whatever on it, and they're then associating it with some art style or character. So this is a big area. Whole Foods is certainly doing it. I mean, you can buy brands at Whole Foods, everything organic, but you can buy the Whole Foods brand as well. And whether it's vitamins for kids, that have a character on it, or something for women that has some nice designs on it. Whole Foods is licensing art and characters, and they're doing it for their private label brands. There you go. The retailer now becomes the licensee. And this is what we call a DTR deal, a direct-to-retail deal. Many, many retail chains, as I mentioned earlier, especially that mid-tier, but all of them are doing it, they're licensing things so that they can have something exclusive. They need something that no one else has. And that's where DTR comes in. Now, in direct-to-retail, you're actually writing your licensing deal not with the manufacturer, but with the retailer. Then the retailer actually funds the manufacturing of the product. More than likely, if they've done it before, they have manufacturers that they like to work with. And you don't have to be involved in any of that except for the approval. So keep in mind, and we'll talk about direct-to-retail more as we get into the sales and contracts and negotiations. But it's an important area of licensing today. So how will retail change more, you know, in the next 10 years? What's the next level of changes, and how will it affect you? So let's talk about that a little bit. And again, I hope you get that the more you read retail news or something like that, the more you can really understand the licensing industry because of the power of the retail chains. You're either going to work with them and figure out a way to work with them, or you're going to figure out a way to work around them. It's one or the other. So there's a few themes that have emerged. I mean, we used to call, when the internet was just starting, we would call the store brick and mortar. So Barnes & Noble had brick and mortar, but then there's B&N.com. So today, no one's referring to brick and mortar, and no one's referring to the internet. It's not brick and click. It's just retail. The reason this transition has happened is a lot because now sales are through the roof. I mean, there was a time when people were looking at the internet and wondering if they should actually put their credit card on it. So those days are over. Everything that a retailer does, they are looking at the whole picture. They're looking at how this will influence, let's say, what they're doing in the retail store, their sales there, and what they're doing online. Everything they're looking at, it's going to influence both. All right, customers in charge. The customers are starting to drive what's at retail more than ever. They're continuously connected. They're giving their opinions. They've got multiple devices everywhere they go. It's either the phone or a tablet or a computer. They have limitless information. They have internet sites that are comparison shopping for them. The consumers are raising the bar for content. They're letting us know what they want, when they want it. They want product quality. They want innovation. They want designer looks at discount prices, right? They don't care anymore if they're shopping at a no-name store. They just want the look they want, when they want it, at the price they want. So all of that consumer input is really, really impacting the retail industry. So on slide 33, we continue. There's new competition. I mean, there's new niche players in every kind of industry. So there's internet sites that are competing with those retailers for every different type of product they sell. Personalization. This has been on our tongues for 10 years, but now it's really happening. I mean, you can go to a print-on-demand company and have beautiful art, but also your name, your family name, your child's image. All of that, it's going to even be in retail stores. So if you're really okay with being a part of that, that's a great area to head into. new generation of retailers will emerge. They're going to be very agile and adaptable, and they're going to be catering to the digitally obsessed, right? All right. Just looking here. Okay. Slide for 34. So app growth is apt to change your buying habits. I didn't really realize until I started upping my research here that apps now are getting so big that people are going through apps rather than directly to the websites. And so app use has grown 76%, and for Android phones alone, 220% in the last year. I mean, amazing. Top retailers are really now taking notes of apps. So now, not only do they need to have a website, but they need to have an app. And Target has said that 68% of the time spent on 68% of time spent on Target mobile properties was through apps versus the web. And this is a 21% increase from 2013. So they're really feeling that the mobile app is the new door to Target. Very, very important. They are, again, loving the customers that walk through the front door, but they are no longer considering that their only front door. I mean, really, really, this is big news. And it's going to be affecting our licensing. So how has this changed the licensing industry and the art licensing industry? I've given you a few hints already on slide 35, which we're going to talk about the fact that as soon as you enter the industry now, you are competing with the bigger art and design brands immediately. There's no way to enter the market any longer where you can kind of grow and incubate as there used to be. So I think that that's important to know. If you don't know that, you'll be blindsided. So when a manufacturer is looking at you, they are considering you next to the best designers in the world. But the fact is, those manufacturers still need something fresh, and they still need something new, and they still are trying to satisfy specific needs they have. I'll give that example later. Anyway, distribution to the customer is key. We've talked about that. There are more options than before, but it can be more confusing. And print-on-demand with personalization will become more important. Print-on-demand I have a lot of feelings about because I see artists starting out and they start out by opening a Zazzle store. It can totally waste your time because all the time you put into putting it up, then you don't market it. Zazzle doesn't market you. You have to market you. All it is a way to do print-on-demand products. Cafe Press is the other one. And there are a ton of companies that will print one mug, 10 mugs. No longer do you have to order 5,000 minimum, 10,000, 20,000 minimum. You can order a small quantity and sell product. But the fact is that those products are very bland. What they do is they give you an area for your image. You can put it in there, but nothing else is really going to change. And it's not a great way to design product, to be limited by this little teeny print area, and it's a white mug, and that's it. So I think that you have to put into perspective what print-on-demand with Cafe Press can do for you. Eventually, it'll just get in the way. You'll find a manufacturer to do mugs, and you'll have to shut down what you're doing on Zazzle. And or Cafe Press. So think about that. If you really, really believe that you want to sell online and that that's the only way to do it, then spend time marketing and make some money. But it's kind of counterproductive to the licensing industry. If you want to be in this industry, you should be spending your time marketing yourself to the major manufacturers who can sell 30,000 mugs, 50,000 mugs, and 100,000 mugs. All right, page 36, we have more industry changes. You need to be prepared to create a track record that gives you leverage. Remember how I said there's no longer a soft, cushy place for you to enter this market? That's really true. More and more people are coming into this market, so the competition is tougher, and the manufacturers are more risk-averse than ever. They want to look at you and see that you already have a track record. They want to know what you've done and how you can prove or convince them that you will sell at the retail level. What can you do? I had an amazing interview this week with Deborah Valencia, and I loved her optimism and get up and go. And I'm amazed. She's only been in licensing for 6 years. So she's a great example of someone who has really launched and leveraged themselves quickly. That's very quickly to have the number of licensees that she's got. She actually decided that she couldn't get a good agent, not a good enough agent, unless she had some deals. And she spent the first 4 years just working to get her own deals until she had, I think, 32 deals over a four-year period. And at that time, people were getting to know her and getting to know her name. So she then was able to get a really good agent, and the last 2 years increased even more in her licensing endeavors. So I think she has it right. I think she did exactly what people should be doing. They should really get out there and do it on their own. They'll also be learning about agents. And we'll talk a lot more about agents. But I wanted to share that story because I was really impressed. And it's great to meet not only a nice person, but someone who's ambitious and is willing to do whatever it takes to get the job done. So competition's tougher, and manufacturers are kind of coming back and testing the waters, but they're still risk adverse. They do not want to be producing 10,000 of something and have it sitting on a shelf, waiting to see if you're going to prove yourself. Okay. So the new retail reality is that really this industry is no longer what I'm calling a free commission-based business. There are investments you have to make. You're going to invest in your education. You're going to invest in your website. You're going to invest in marketing yourself. It's like any entrepreneurial business that you start. You have to set up a budget. You have to set up a budget for marketing. You have to set up a budget for sales, for trade shows, things like that. It's still less expensive than a lot of industries, but you have to also consider the amount of time and effort it's going to take over the number of years, because that budget may just be living expenses for 2.5 years while I get my licensing business off the ground. All right. And, of course, professionalism, the utmost professionalism is expected in this industry. So let's talk a little bit about profits, promotion, and protection. This is slide 37 as we dive into how the numbers work. How is it that you make that $50,000, $100,000, $300,000, $1 million? How does it work? And so I hope you can appreciate, again, I've gotten the most up-to-date numbers that I can. The 2014 numbers are really not out yet, but we're not seeing a lot of change in the art licensing industry, and its stability and consistency is good news. We definitely receive lower royalty rates than the character licensing industry or the fashion industry. because it's not until you have a lot of demand and you start crossing over into being a brand that you can earn the higher rates or a rate that's above the industry average or range. All right, so art licensing has the average royalty of 6.4%. I love that. I think it's hysterical. It's average, right? What's average? There is no average. That's why I'm laughing. There is no average. It's just every type of property of every type of product also has a range. So if every property type and every product type has a range, then it's hard to have an average. Anyway, I'll explain further. Art licensing royalties, as I mentioned, are lower than the industry, the overall industry, unfortunately. But there was a time when all the manufacturers bought with a flat fee their art. And that was it. They weren't paying any artist for that art on each product that sells. And so it's taken a while to build up the licensing industry in the art arena. Royalties have remained in the 6 to 7% range for nearly 10 years in the licensing industry. So what are the factors influencing royalty rates? The property type. So that's the law of supply and demand. If Barbie's really hot, she gets a bigger royalty. If Tina Higgins has exactly the look that people are looking for, or some other artist, then they might get an extra percentage because somebody wants them exclusive and wants another manufacturer not to have that artist. So the type of property will influence your royalty rate. The product type also influences the royalty rate. So let me give an example. Paper. Paper is going up in cost because of trees and the environment and people complaining about using trees for paper and recycling and all that stuff costs money, and paper goes up in price. Thus, the manufacturers have a lower percentage of money that they're making, which means the manufacturers can't afford to pay you as high a royalty. So in the paper products arena, the royalties have gone down. It's all related. In ceramics, if somebody's producing in China and they can sell it at a higher in store, they have a bigger margin, they can probably afford to pay you more. So the royalties are related to the product type and where it's manufactured and the margin of profit that the manufacturer is making. The distribution channels, of course, make a difference. I just mentioned that if you're selling the same piece of ceramic at a Ross store or a TJ Maxx, you're not going to make the same royalty as if you were in Neiman Marcus. Low margin industries, paper is one. There are others, but it depends on the product type. But low margin industries, publishing is a low margin industry. Video games tend to be, they've got such high development costs, but when the development's done, it's very easy for them to sell millions and millions more, duplicating it. There's basically very, very little cost, especially when you're downloading digital products. So there are a lot of industries that would have high margins because of digital distribution these days. And non-exclusive versus exclusive. Often, as I've mentioned, people will get a little bit of a bump in their royalty because somebody wants an exclusive. Now, if you're licensing one piece of art exclusive, you're not going to get a higher royalty. They're going to offer you 5%, you're going to accept 5%, and you're done. It's if they want all of your art, whether they're trying to keep you from being with their competitor. Or maybe you have a collection that they love. So they might take that entire collection and they don't want it to appear anywhere else. They may or may not. That's kind of an in-between. But they might be willing to pay a little extra to make sure that appears nowhere else. And especially if somebody's licensing it for a broad number of products. So if it's just, you know, one piece of art for two types of stationery, no, even though they want exclusivity, they're not going to pay for it. You're going to give it to them because you don't want to compete with yourself. You don't want to go license the same art, even if it's not exclusive for note cards. You don't want to go over here and license it for note cards. Then you'd be just competing with yourself. Half of the money that you could make over here would go over here. And then they're not happy, and then they're not happy. And you've got two unhappy manufacturers. So the manufacturers know that. They know that if you're smart, you're not going to go license one piece of art on the same type of product elsewhere. They don't really need to do an exclusive. They don't really need to pay extra. But if they want all of your photography, all of your art, all of your animal art, every single piece of animal art you've ever done, and you only do animals and flowers, that's a huge amount of art that you can't go elsewhere. And they want to do 10 different products. So it's really hard for you to find other product areas to work around them. I mean, they're a broad-based manufacturer. So then I think you need to be talking with them about an extra royalty percentage for that exclusivity. All right, so keep in mind the factors influencing royalty rates. All right, let's work through a royalty example. And if you need a piece of scrap paper, I need a calculator. Doesn't matter what I do, I need a calculator. Even when I round them out to be really nice numbers, but that's okay. So in this example, the retail price is $10. Doesn't matter what the product is. And the wholesale price, this is the manufacturer's wholesale net price, is $5. Today, in general, you can consider the wholesale price approximately half. It's either half or a little less, never more. Okay, so it might be $4.50 or $5, okay, or even $4. It's a little bit lower than it used to be. Used to be always half, exactly. All right, so if your royalty rate is 7%, you're going to be multiplying your royalty rate times the $5. And you're going to be making 35 cents on each product. So if they're producing and selling, not just producing, but producing and selling, it's called sell-through. If they're 10,000 products, that'd be $3,500. In your pocket, of course, that would then be split with your agent or yours alone. And if they sell 20,000, then you have $7,000 for yourself or to split with your agent. Let me mention that publishing is the only area where the royalty is computed on the suggested retail price or basically the selling price. And also I would say that in Japan, they also do a lot of computations, computing royalties on the retail price. But you can deal with that down the road when you've exploded out of the U.S. market. All right. So let's work through another royalty example. And this is on slide 41. So if the retail price is $5, then your manufacturer's wholesale price is $2.50. If the royalty rate is 6%, in the upstairs market, and the royalty rate is 3% in the mass market. Let me explain this. I see this in contracts all the time. They basically sign a contract with you that says, if we sell it into the upstairs market or specialty or, you know, they might name the types of stores, we'll give you 6%. But if Costco takes it or Walmart takes it, it's 3%. and you sign off on it. And so now you know that you're either going to make 15 cents for every product or 7.5 cents for each product. And, you know, if you look at it like this and you're like, gosh, I don't know. I'm not sure if I really want to be in the mass market. But remember that a lower royalty rate with higher sales can actually make you more money. So what you want to do is you want to go to that next level and figure out which it is. If you're working with a small manufacturer who says, flat out, I'm only making, you know, 10,000, that's it, I'm not going back to press, you can compute how much you're going to make. And one of the best questions that you can ask anybody is, what's your first production run? Do you expect to sell that out? How often do you reprint? Because if you get somebody to answer that, you can go back and start computing. Okay, I know that they sell at retail for $6. Okay, so $3. Maybe it's $2.75. He's offering me 6%. You can start calculating. And if he only sells for 10,000, then I know I'll make this much. But he says he usually goes back for a reprint. So that'd be another 10,000 if I do well. So what I'm suggesting is start to learn the numbers you need to ask about. You only need to know the royalty rate, the net wholesale price, and the print run or the production run to be able to start to compute how much money you'd make on a deal. And if you ask somebody how much their sales are, what would you project your sales to be if we worked together on this deal? They might him and haw and not answer you. But if you ask them specifically, what's your first production run that you do on calendars? You're doing scarves. What's your production run? How often do you reprint? What do you find your best brands are? How many times do you find your best brands reprinting throughout the year? Do you always do 10,000 production run, or do you have some brands where you do more? When you start out with an artist, do you always do the same production run to start out with? Find ways that you're comfortable asking those key questions. That's what's really going to make a difference, is for you to own those questions and get them out and get the answers. All right, so let's look at these calculations now. If the wholesale price, the net wholesale price is $250, and you're at 6%, you're making 15 cents per product, and they only produce 5,000, you'd make $750. Or if they produce 10,000, you make $1,500. Well, at half the royalty rate, you've got to sell 100,000 products. Oh, excuse me, you've got to sell 20,000 products to make the same $1,500. But you know in mass market, they've got thousands of stores. They're putting 100 in each store. Their first print run is quadruple what it would have been. So you can start seeing that 50,000, 100,000, even 200,000 is absolutely possible. And you start getting a little more comfortable with that 3% royalty. And again, I see a lot of contracts that surprise people because they don't understand why I'm being offered a 3% royalty. So the next slide shows you a calendar example where the royalty rate of 10% is quite traditional for an art licensing property, even if you're new, and because they don't do huge print runs. Calendars today, as I mentioned, with digital calendars being around, their sales are just not that great anymore, and they like to do lots of niche calendars. So if you're like Flora and Fauna of the Northwest, then great, but you're not going to sell a million copies of it. If you're lucky, you're going to sell 20 or 30,000, which is great. Most calendar companies that sell 30,000 would be excited to reprint you the next year and have you back. Usually they're looking for 12 new images. And you know the thing that I hear most on calendars these days is, well, this is a lot on humor calendars. They're like, well, I don't see people really living with that for a month. So if you're doing a mock-up for a calendar, really, really think hard about somebody spending a whole month with that one image. All right. So I hope you understand how the royalties are computed. And certainly as we talk about negotiations and contracts in the fourth part of our series, we'll get into more detail about how to negotiate those numbers and what to expect for the different types of products and properties and things like that. But for right now, we want to talk about promotion. Promotion is essential to the art licensing business, just as it is to any business. Promotion is marketing, really. It's promoting yourself. It's the after process of selling or purchasing in a marketplace. It's the process of promoting, selling, or distributing. And it's the aggregate of all those functions and things that have to happen to get your art out to that consumer. So you must think about yourself promoting yourself. First thing you have to do, and I'm on slide 45, is to define your target audience. And that sounds like, oh, well, I know who my target audience is. I have a lot of people who know who their consumer audience is, but they forget that in the licensing business, they're going to be targeting themselves to the manufacturers or an agent. If you want to get an agent before you start going to manufacturers, which is your choice, then that's who your target audience would be. So make a decision about who you're targeting. And certainly you're going to be targeting consumers who enjoy your art. That's your B2C or your business. You're the business to consumer, the B2C market target audience. And then your efforts in the B2C area have to do with your consumers. Then the B2B, which is the business-to-business marketplace, are your efforts which have to do with talking to manufacturers or finding an agent who will talk to manufacturers. It's the business of running your business. And it has nothing to do with whether the consumers like your art or not. It has to do with whether you're actually getting out into the marketplace to sell something. Remember that you may have a lot of different audiences for your art. I mean, women may be the primary target audience, or kids, dog lovers. It may be men. It may be gay men. I don't know who you're targeting. You may feel like you're upscale. You may feel like you're everyday. You may be humor. You may be fine art. So make sure that you're definitely putting efforts out there toward your consumer market. But you need to communicate now to the manufacturers and agents who your audiences are, but to talk in the language of those businesses. So I think that's where people go awry. They put up a consumer website and they forget that the manufacturer really doesn't want to come and labor through all your consumer promotions and ideas. And, you know, you're talking to kids and they're like, you know, enough of this. They want a website that's targeted to them, a brochure that's targeted to them. They want you on your phone call to talk to them in their language. That's why it's really important to identify the difference between your consumer audience and your B2B audience. All right. On slide 46, we're talking about promotion. And really, these are the things that you're going to be using to market your business. Your website is number one. As we just talked about, you need a business-to-business website. You're going to do mailings. You're going to be doing emails and snail mail. Probably a lot less snail mail. You're going to be doing social media. You're going to be doing that. And again, you're going to be dividing your communication and the way you talk between your consumers and the business people that you work with. You're going to use LinkedIn for your business-to-business communication. You're going to be using Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest for your consumer marketplace. You're going to be doing public relations. Nothing is more important than doing PR about your business for your business. It's economical, and it's something that you can really leverage. You're going to be doing trade shows. One way or the other, you're going to be walking them, learning about them, you're going to be attending them, you're going to be having a booth at them. Trade shows are critically important in this business. And you may even have some budget. After all else failed, no, I didn't mean failed. At the end, if you have budget left over, you do advertising. I just want to make the point that I don't put advertising at the top of the list, because I don't think you get out of it the dollars you put into it, and that you really need the platform of all of these other types of promotion before you do advertising. That's what's really important. And lastly, I just want to say that we will discuss all of these in a lot of detail in our marketing and sales techniques class. That's the third part of the Art Licensing Essentials course. Now, protecting your rights. Get a lot of questions about these. Remember that you own your copyright the minute you create a piece of art, or take a photograph, or design a character or a pattern. So from the time you create it, whether you register it with the U.S. Copyright Office or not, you own it. Make sure you put the copyright, the circle C shown on the screen, and the year and your name, whatever your company brand name is, make sure you put that on every piece of art. I highly recommend that you start registering with the U.S. Copyright Office before you license your art. So you may start promoting your business, but if you think you're starting to get to a point where you're out promoting it and you're going to get some deals or your first deal, make sure that you go ahead and register the collection or the individual pieces with the Copyright Office. You always own your reproduction rights, and nobody can reproduce your art and images without your permission. But what copyright and registered trademark do, what this does is it allows you to fight for your rights. Copyright, registered trademark, and TM, a register mark and the TM for trademark, do not protect you automatically. No way, no how. What they do is they allow you to fight for your rights. In other words, if someone does infringe upon you and you've registered your copyright, you then have one more foothold to prove that these are your images, your creation, the date that they were created, that no one else has them, and that you could prove it, and that way you could, if you were so inclined, sue somebody for fraudulent use. So what they don't do is protect you automatically. They provide you the opportunity to defend yourself and to be compensated for misuse. I think that that's just a really, really important thing to understand at this point as you're venturing off into the business. Of course, I'm not a lawyer. I think that if you are not comfortable with registering your copyrights online and you need help doing that, then hire somebody to help you. But it's an important step. So let's look at the contract elements on slide 48. These are the basic elements that need to go in any contract. The licensor and licensee information, the description of the product and the artwork, the term, as well as the termination date, and I also think that a marketing date should go in there. That means the day that they expect by this date your product will be on the market. Rights, whether they're exclusive or non-exclusive, certainly. The territory which they expect to be selling. The royalty rate that you will be paid. The advance against royalties, if they are going to pay an advance against royalties. A lot of companies are not these days. The guarantee, again, unless you have a highly sought after property, you're probably not going to be paid a guarantee. And the retail channels of distribution. Some people don't put that in contracts, but I think that rather than be surprised by requesting it be put in there, the least that can happen is you'll have a discussion about where your product is going to be distributed. Now, you don't want to ever sign any kind of contract that gives away all of your copyrights. You want to keep your full reproduction rights and even permission to sublicense art to other companies is not a good idea. And basically, it's an agent that is allowed to sublicense. Other than that, if it's a manufacturer and they say, we have the right to sublicense your art to other manufacturers, they're basically asking to be your agent. You want to cross that out. You do not want that. And a lot of manufacturers will ask for worldwide rights, but they may not use them. Or they may not have even the ability to sell worldwide, except on the internet. You've got to ask questions. Why? Anyway, don't ever send your original art. Of course, that's certainly not as much of an issue as it used to be. Now, pretty much people are very, very used to sending their art digitally. But there was a time when I had a lot of people calling crazy because they sent some original art to a manufacturer and couldn't get it back. Slide number 50 illustrates the licensing pie. Because really, licensing is all about slicing the pie. It's about taking your rights that you own and for the rights for something you've created, and you want to take those rights and slice them in as small pieces as possible. You want to say, like your grandmother, I just want that little piece. Just give me a little sliver. That's all I want. You want to take that little sliver and make sure that the contract reflects that and that you're not giving them the whole pie. You want to give them exactly what they ask for and no more. Don't ever give anybody any rights that they do not need and they do not plan to execute. So in this example, one piece of art might be used for two calendar formats. And it might be a brand. In the Dilbert case that I mentioned, we had so many cartoons, we were able to do 9 different calendars. Now they were different cartoons and different formats, but they were still calendars. So we gave certain companies the rights to these two calendar formats, and we gave this calendar company the rights to these calendars, and these formats, and these cartoons. And we're slicing that pie as thin as we can. So maybe this is, mentions tea towels and pot holders. You're using the same art for that. You're using it for journals, notepads, and stationery. So you've now used several pieces of art for the same, for different types of products, but you can still do mugs, area rugs, puzzles, platters, paper plates, napkins, aprons, magnets. The list goes on and on. So that's really becomes your job. You're a creator, but you're trying to find as many companies as possible that want the rights to as many pieces of art as possible. Now, I have a contract philosophy. I'm on slide 51. I think that it's really good to have your own boilerplate contract, even if you don't use it every time, and you won't use it every time. The manufacturer will say, no, please use mine. But by having your own contract, you will then learn what a good licensing contract looks like. You'll learn the ins and outs of every section, and you'll be able to protect yourself better. Remember also that contracts are only as good and true as the understanding between the two people who've negotiated them. If from day one you're not believing what somebody says, then follow your gut, because the piece of paper is only as good as the people behind it. I always hope that you'll take that contract and just file it away and never have to look at it again, and that everything will run really, really smoothly. But contracts are in place for those times when things go wrong and when someone cannot fulfill their promises, and you've got to go back and rely on what was said. You know, in other words, you promised you'd do this, you need to do this. You're obligated to do this, and I'm obligated to do that. So, do you need a lawyer? Very, very important question. I had a lawyer once when I read this slide a couple of years ago, before I'd updated the class, and they just cheered when I said this, because lawyers alone, you know, they get asked, what should I do? And the fact is, they don't know what you should do. A lawyer is not a business advisor. A lawyer is a legal advisor. They are there to create protective language to make sure that your copyright's protected, that there's nothing in the contract that you cannot fulfill, that there's nothing outrageous in the contract that the manufacturer is going to do that would be abusive or hurtful to your business or something like that. So they are incredibly important, and having them read it can be invaluable. But you need someone who's going to tell you that's a good deal until you can learn that that's a good deal. And that's what a licensing agent or a coach will do. They'll help you determine if this is fair and why. And if you go to a lawyer and say, here's my contract, I just really want you to look at the terms, well, no, the lawyer shouldn't be looking at the terms. The lawyer should be looking at the legal definitions and making sure that they're accurate and appropriate. And a business person should say, yeah, 3% is a great deal for that. You really are not going to get anything more. Or, oh my gosh, how can they offer you 5%? You should be getting 10. You know, ask for 12 and you'll get 10. You need, until you can learn it on your own, you need to find out what you can get and where and when and why. And that is not the lawyer's job. They do not know what royalty rate a rug should get. They do not know what Giclée's royalty on Giclée's should be. They just don't, unless they do this all day long. So I just want to encourage you to understand the difference between the two, that every contract has business terms and every contract has legal terms. All right. And the question arises, in the licensing industry, do I need an agent? Well, actually, a lot of people come in with the attitude of, I want an agent. And once they learn about the business, they start thinking a little more like, well, I think I could do that. Or they hear that example about Deborah Valencia and they say, well, I think I should do that. And there's a lot of things that can happen as you start to learn about the industry. So, do I need an agent? Maybe if you don't want to be in sales or you're not confident about your sales skills. I will remind you, though, you're always still going to be selling yourself. You even have to sell yourself to your agent. Maybe you need an agent if you don't want to spend most of your time selling versus creating art. Maybe you need an agent if you want to jumpstart sales. Agents have a lot of industry contacts. They can definitely get deals faster than you can. And maybe you need an agent if you are definitely okay with sharing a large percentage of every deal. It may be worth it to you. The business coach, like this type of training, is great to learn about the business. And I think that what happens is there's a certain amount that you can learn from classes and through classes, and then at a certain point you've taken your business as far as it can go and you need some help to get it to the next level. And that may not be a lot of help. It may be just some pinpoint help. So think about that. Also, if you're not comfortable sharing a large percentage of your potential income, then you've obviously got to be trained somehow. So consider a business coach, consider a lawyer, use them wisely. I'm all for budgeting and making sure that you're using the appropriate expert at the appropriate time. Now, our last section of this class is going to be the artist requirements and the agent and artist relationship. Where do you start? I'm on slide 56. It starts with a decision. Do you want to add art licensing to your revenue stream, or are you comfortable with where your sales are now? I'm sure that most of you have thought about this and have maybe even made that decision. Although it can change as you learn about the industry, that you've probably made the decision that you want to go into art licensing and that you've got the talent, the determination. Maybe you've got the time, maybe you've got the resources. I hope so. What does art licensing today require? This kind of gives you an idea. It's not just your artistic talent or your passion for seeing your ideas on products, which are totally essential. You've got to understand retail distribution. You've got to have the technical skills or access to them to work in this business. You need to be a trend watcher. Even if your art doesn't follow trends, it's still important. You need the ability to develop and provide production files, and you need product design capabilities. And this is the one I think that surprises most people, because they think, oh, the manufacturer will do that. But we're going to talk about that in our next session. You really need product line development skills and the ability to create designs that will work on multiple product types. Also, there's a lot of entrepreneurial skills that you're going to need in the art licensing industry. Besides being willing to learn the industry itself and your professionalism, certainly time management, the ability to meet deadlines, be flexible, lots of marketing knowledge, contract review, and follow through and persistence. I mean, these are just the starting place. But it can be pretty exciting. Now, the agent-artist relationship on slide 59. finally give you the numbers maybe that you've been looking for. But agent fees range from 40 to 50%. I have seen them as low as 30%. Not very often. 35, yeah. But 40, 45, 50 all the time. And I've seen them as high as 75, which is just absolutely unacceptable. Actually, nothing over 50% should be accepted. And that's for an agent who's doing a lot of branding and marketing work for you. Everything. All your marketing. Many agents do charge an initial development fee in addition to the commission. That's happening a lot more if your art or property needs some development. Happens a lot in the character arena because you have to develop the property more. Legal, production, and travel costs are usually in addition to commissions. So just keep that in mind. What I'm trying to do is make sure that you understand how agents work. So on slide 60, I've really outlined the different skill sets of an agent. And these are the different things that an agent can do for you, but I said can do for you. Not all of them do it. And nor do they claim to. I'm not saying they're liars. I'm just saying that every agent is different in what they offer. Every agent has a different package or combination of what they're offering. So some offer client management, most of them do, and strategic planning. Some offer no creative development. So in other words, they don't help you have an eye on what's happening in the marketplace. They may just say, give me your art and I'm going to market it. And I think about some of the larger agencies that take a lot of fine artists, but they have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of art up on their websites, and basically they're a catalog. So you upload your fine art, people can look through it, and if they pick it, great, you get a deal, and if not, you don't. So they're not spending a lot of time on sales and marketing. They're basically providing a catalog of art. And that's very different from somebody who's helping you build a brand and really out there talking with manufacturers about you and marketing everything that you do and talking with manufacturers about not just what you've done but what you can create next and how you're going to do it. All right, so sales and marketing, the manufacturer, account management, certainly they would do that. Accounting, sometimes it's included. Certainly, they're accounting, but you've got your own to do. Legal, usually outsourced. Not a lot of agencies have it in-house. So you need to make sure that you understand how they work their legal part of the deal and whether you would be receiving any further legal, you know, bills. That's the bottom line, is you want to know what they're offering and what you're going to be charged for in addition to the commission that you're paying. Bottom line is you don't want any surprises. All right, the agent versus coaching. Slide 61, just wanted to point out that art licensing is actually a really interesting industry because the manufacturers are very willing to talk to the artists directly. They don't require that you have an agent at all. They're happy either way. So your agent would work up front with licensees, and or you do it yourself. And what we're showing here is just the way that an agent versus a coach would work. If you're trying to build your business quickly and you want to have someone working behind the scenes to give you answers and teach you how to manage your business, it does cost you, but it's a lower cost to you overall. But it's always behind the scenes. It's when you need it, as you need it. And with an agent, no matter what they do, you pay a full percentage, a flat percentage. I don't have a preference for what you do. You just got to learn the differences between doing it yourself and having an agent, or doing it yourself with a coach or without a coach. Just it's all business decisions. All right. So how do you find an agent? I think one of the best resources is LIMA, which is the Licensing International Licensing Industry Merchandisers Association. And they have agents listed on their website. You can go through the list and see which ones would be appropriate. Trade publications also list agents that are doing deals. Always great to still look at publicity and see who's promoting themselves. And you can prepare to sell yourself then to reputable agents just like you would sell yourself to a manufacturer. There's really no difference. Talk to licensed artists. That's a great way. If somebody's got a great agent, believe me, they would be happy to tell you. And if they've had problems, they'll be happy to tell you as well. Attend trade shows is a great way to look at the agents and see how they promote themselves. So we have now come to the conclusion of our part one of Art Licensing Essentials. We've covered a lot, and we probably also inspired a lot of questions. Please go ahead and make sure that I have those questions. If I can answer them for you, I will. Always love to hear from everyone, so thank you for joining us today.